Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about being compliant or holding our public servants in compliance. In other words, that's your job. We need to be the ones demanding that they abide by the law and stay within the framework of the Constitution. And that's some of the things that we've kind of been coming up with as we've been talking about the Constitutional Convention, is as some of these men were creating these arguments that, oh, well, they'll be able to do this or this and this, like Governor Morris just a couple of days ago, where he just thought that, you know, they would have all these latitudes, that they would just, you know, really amass a bunch of power. Well, they only have the power that's delegated. The only way they can amass more power is through a constitutional amendment. So, anyway, it's easy to have, you know, 2020 vision when we're looking at it from this perspective. They still hadn't formulated everything. So, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, castigate or cast aspersions on, you know, their shallowness or what have you. There were some that had hard biases, and all of that stuff is really coming out. And I think if anything is an advantage of going through this, we can literally prove, folks, that what we've been told, that our framers are a bunch of racist slave owners, that's a lie. Do you not agree with me, Sean? And Sean, you may actually be muted still, but would you agree with that?
I agree with you.
Okay.
And I think this whole narrative that the country is founded on white supremacy and it's baked in is absolutely ridiculous and ludicrous.
There you go. Okay. So there's a huge advantage of actually reading these source documents if you want to understand our history. There was no intent by James Madison that, oh, down the road, they're going to, if we really told them what we were thinking, then they would think we're a bunch of racists. They didn't care. They didn't care about that. They were trying to keep everything honest, truthful. They didn't have agendas. They weren't, their pens weren't necessarily guided by a narrative in trying to do a psyop with, you know, the American people like we have our government doing today. So we were just covering, and we were kind of in the middle of this idea of citizenship and so forth, and Sean, you brought up this idea of trade, and I basically, at the very end of the show, I kind of pointed to the fact that the president is the one that has the controls over who we really trade with. He has the ability to earmark or identify who our enemies are, and we cannot openly, freely trade with our enemy. That the president has to basically say, okay, they're no longer an enemy. And so when Nixon did it, when China was our enemy, there's nothing that changed. He did it because the intent was to build up a second enemy to the United States instead of just being us and Russia. We needed a second big enemy that we could instill more fear in America, where when the time came and they were ready to capitulate, people would say, you know what, we might as well just capitulate because we don't want to go to war with these two evil, you know, I'll just say enemies that we're facing, these huge empires. Anyway, I honestly think, because this is where I was going at the end of the show, when you look at what they had to deal with, the decisions that needed to be made, obtaining consensus from the states would have been just hard, if not impossible, to the degree of herding cats. I think most people understand that metaphor. Therefore, you know, creating and giving the power to Congress and the president regarding the dealings with our foreign nations, okay. But I believe that the states need to take a better role and need to have more involvement in really looking at whether these nations are our enemies or not, because the federal government has only proven that they're willing to look the other way for political advantages and wins here in America in controlling us and doing things to us and helping our enemies out than helping us out. You agree?
Yes, sir.
So I believe that there should be an amendment to the Constitution that does empower the states, the state legislatures, to be able to create a motion or a petition amongst the different states to where if we get enough of the states to step in and say, this nation is a threat, Iran is a threat, or better yet, all of Islam is a threat to our sovereignty, that we should not be doing open trade with a nation like Islam, any nation out there that is an Islamic nation. We should not allow them to come into America because, again, folks, we've already covered this. We didn't declare war against them. We're the stupid ones to not recognize that war has already been declared by them. It was declared centuries ago, and they're living it out, and they're laughing at us because they have created doctrines to basically basically infiltrate, undermine, and take over. And if you don't believe me, let's ask the Persians in Iran how they feel about the eradication of Zoroastrianism, where they had a faith called Zoroastrianism. They were Zoroastrians. And so, that faith is dead. It was annihilated by Islam. They're out to do that everywhere. And this only proves the point. So, I believe the states need to actually have a better role, that, you know, the only way that a state, or I should say a foreign nation, foreign nations, would be able to change their status is through the Senate. In other words, shifting, because if you really look at the state legislature, who's the Senate providing suffrage for? The state legislature, right? And when we look at this, you know, the Senate's the one that's doing treaties and doing those types of things in the first place. Well, why wouldn't the state legislature then be able to actually actively, outside of the members of the Senate, because that's only suffrage. I think the state legislature should be able to actively pursue amongst the other state legislatures to say, hey, these guys are a threat. All of these guys that, you know, believe in Islam, all these communist states, they're threats. And we have to have limited involvement, limited trade with them, if not zero trade. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
And what do you think? Do you think that would actually help? Help send the message that we're no longer going to subsidize communism and Islam throughout the world and the destruction of liberty and Christianity.
I totally agree. I mean, I'm not an isolationist, but if a country doesn't have the same principles and values that we have, and they're just like you say, the whole premise of Islam is to spread it throughout the world by any means necessary, including violence. And I mean, that's stated doctrine, just like the Chinese communists, their stated goal is to control the world.
Right.
And we shouldn't be subsidizing any person or nation that states those things.
Right. And seeks advantages over us and seeks to annihilate us, those types of things. So I would even go one step further. And I would believe that, you know, we have to have a automatic position with any foreign nation that wants to place imposts on trades with us. Because, see, we believe in free trade. In other words, we give our goods to you, you know, or not give, but you buy our goods and we don't put a tax on it. We don't put exposts on our goods. And so when you send us your goods, there's an ex post on it. In other words, they put tariffs, or if you want to look at it as in Europe, what do they call that? There's a tax that they put on it. What's it called?
Is it the VAT?
Yes, the value-added tax. Thank you. The value-added tax is something that they automatically place for each different nation because it's different, because the needs of the nations are different. And so in most of the cases, it's, I believe, 20% or more. This pays for, you know, their citizens to be able to have a one-month holiday every year. This pays for, you know, all sorts of things that they want to provide for their citizens in their socialistic world. Well, okay, if you're going to place a 20% VAT on all goods coming from that country into America, we should have a reciprocal tax as well. And the tax, the money we bring in on that reciprocal tax should actually go and pay for those few things constitutionally that we need to do. And I'll bet you anything, when we evaluate our standing in with the world, until the world actually becomes free trade, you know, nations again, we're not going to need income tax. Unless we make this long waging war against Islam, that's going to cost us money. But we don't need to be spending money on things the government has no authority to spend money on. We do need to spend money on those things that they're supposed to actually be doing, like protecting us. And you can't tell me that allowing Iran to continue to move forward in its development with nuclear, you know, weaponry, refinement, and so forth in a weapons program is good. It's not. It's not good. And as a matter of fact, those nations that want to be theocracies, that want to demand theocracy, you know, make the world into their own theocracy, that means that they are at war with us. And they're going to do anything and everything they can. I mean, I noticed that Saudi Arabia, the newspapers have been kind of silent about them. And, you know, I don't watch the news because it's just noise to me. But have you noticed how Saudi Arabia is not taking a position against Iran? Have you noticed
Absolutely.
That? And so, okay, so that means something. That means that Saudi Arabia, you know, they recognize that they have to hold because they do hold a hard line on Islam. Not as hard as some other nations, but they do hold that hard line. Anyway, well, you know what? And the interesting thing is, if we actually go down this path of actually, you know, fully supporting the Constitution and demanding full compliance of the Constitution, then what will actually change is Saudi Arabia's ownership in America goes to zero. They won't own the PGA. They won't own these golf courses. They won't own these assets and resources because constitutionally, the federal government doesn't have the authority to allow them to own it, nor does any state have the authority to allow them to be sold and bought and controlled by a foreign entity. Those things are prohibited in the Constitution. Ergo, the fact that the federal government has been trying to sell out America is a direct violation of what they're supposed to be doing. So Saudi Arabia and the billions of dollars that they've invested in buying into these things that, you know, they love to do and or own and control and possess, it's all going to go away from them. In other words, they're going to not have anything. They're not getting anything in return for it. Because buyer beware. If you're going to buy the Picasso, the person you're buying that Picasso from better have the legitimate deed and the or the legitimate power of attorney to give or to sell you that Picasso, to do that transaction with you. Because if Saudi Arabia actually did their due diligence and looked at the Constitution and said, you know what, you guys don't have the authority to do these things, then they wouldn't have spent their money. Ah, but everybody's doing it, so let's go into America and buy it all up. It's for sale. And like that, it can be gone. All the states need to do is say, where is the authority for this land to be sold to a foreign entity and controlled by a foreign entity? Sorry, you can't do it. That's not there. In other words, it has to be enumerated. There's nowhere in the Constitution that allows the federal government to basically leverage, sell, and allow the transactions of transfers of ownership of America, of any part, piece, asset of America to be transferred to a foreign nation. So why is all this hoopla? If it's not delegated, you know, the lawyers want you to think, oh, well, this needs to go to court. No, it doesn't. Remember, the court's jurisdiction is based on what, Sean?
Law and fact.
Law and fact. So that is how they can actually adjudicate a case. They can't just interpret the law. They have to base it on how the law has been defined for them. Out of the ratification base or out of the amendment or what have you, they can't change the law. They have no legal authority to do that. And in addition, their jurisdiction is limited to what?
The Constitution.
There you go. All things arising under this Constitution. So their doors can't even open when it comes down to the federal government. You know, hey, the federal government had the legitimate, because they passed these laws, to allow them to sell state resources. No, it's not legitimate. So it doesn't arise under the Constitution. If there's an amendment in the Constitution that allowed that, then the federal courts would actually have jurisdiction. But guess who has jurisdiction over their land? It's not the federal government, because that's not federal government. The states are sovereigns, right? They're independent sovereigns. That's their land. So every state legislature could literally go and go, hold on, I'm not seeing anywhere where these are legitimate transactions. And as far as I'm concerned, the people that helped these transactions move through that were in the federal positions and state positions all ought to be rounded up and charged for treason. Because they literally violated the Constitution by assuming powers not delegated and allowed a foreign nation to seize control, to basically, you know, start funneling money out of America into their arms, into their war machines, what have you. And so, folks, these things need to be happening. They need to be happening quickly. Which is why I keep on haranguing you to get involved in holding your public servants accountable. We got petitions that cover all of these types of things. Even the state property, state land. We've got enough to keep your county commissioners or supervisors, whatever you have, as local legislators. We've got enough to keep them busy in working for you and going after the state and waking the state up to do their cotton picking job. And that's the same thing. We've got plenty that it all goes, you know, it all filters, the crap rolls downhill. It all filters down. And so it'll all end up going down to the federal government saying, you have no authority to be even doing these things. These are the services you can render, and that's it. Anyway, we are still covering the Constitution Convention, and we kind of wrapped up, and I just wanted to cover closely this citizenship, this qualifications, trade, which kind of wandered into all of that. And I believe that there is merit for making changes to the Constitution to where the Senate, and actually freeing up the state legislatures so that the state legislatures can communicate with each other in basically coming up with the go, no-go trade countries. And so I understand that there may be some protectionism, but this is where we will have a hard time getting, you know, a majority of the states, because what should it be? Should it be two-thirds? Should it be 50% plus one? I don't know. Whatever it takes to find that right, to do this right. And I believe if we all look at the way the situation has been played out, It cannot remain the way it is, where the federal government can continually sell us downriver. If we take that back, then they don't have the ability to do that. But it would still be the federal government, because it would be coming out of the Senate. The Senate would then have the ability to establish who our real threats are. And it wouldn't be dictated by the personalities or the political leanings of a president. It would create a much better stable position and a stable path forward, so that there would be no, you know, well, who's going to make president? Because that's going to determine whether we're good people or bad people. Anyway, so we're jumping forward again, and this next part that we're going to read is a unique one. And it has to do with property again, but this is really where the federal government becomes the umpires, where we kind of talk about this idea that the federal government and the court system's job is to really be more of an umpire. So if we move down to August 10th, and August 10th starts off with Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina talking about property, and I kind of add the words or impose these words, umpires. This is kind of what their role is. They're not there to control us. They're there to make sure that based on the laws we created, that we're all going to abide by those laws. That they're there to make sure that nobody's taking advantage, ignoring, or what have you. So are you with me? This is down on page 282.
Mr. Madison, electors?
No. This is in blue. This is down.
Okay. Mr. Pinckney, South Carolina.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
All righty, sir.
Okay.
The committee, as he had conceived, were instructed to report the proper qualifications of property for the members of the national legislature, instead of which they have referred the task to the national legislature itself. Should it be left on this footing, the first legislature will meet without any particular qualifications of property, and if it should happen to consist of rich men, they might fix such qualifications that may be too favorable to the rich. If a poor man, an opposite extreme might be run into. He was opposed to the establishment of an undue aristocratic influence in the Constitution, but he thought it essential that the members of the legislature, the executive, and the judges should be possessed of competent property to make them independent and respectable. It was prudent, then, such great powers were to be trusted to connect the tie of property with that of reputation in securing a faithful administration. The legislature would have the fate of the nation put into their hands. The president would also have very good, great influence on it. The judges would have not only the important causes between citizen and citizen, but also where foreigners are concerned. They will even be the umpires between the United States and individual states, as well as between one state and another. Were he to fix the quantum of property which should be required, he should not think of less than $100,000 for the president, half that sum for each of the judges, and a like proportion for the members of the national legislature. He would, however, leave the sums blank. His motion was that the president of the United States, the judges, and members of the legislature should be required to swear that they were respectively possessed of a cleared, unencumbered estate to the amount of blank in the case of the president, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. So, again, how many people throughout the different states would be able to come to such a high bar? Because now let's think about this. In the Carolinas and in Virginia, these large plantations, there are people that could amass, and it would be common that there'd be a high percentage of these millionaires or thousandaires, right? We'll call them thousandaires. A very archaic. But the point is this. The point is that we're going into break, and could have timed that more better or more perfectly, or could have timed it better. How about that? Either way, when we come back, we will talk about this. We'll actually dive into you know, out of the different states, is there even a likelihood that there would be in the future that type of holdings for that requirement? We'll be right back.
Listen to my show, Reclaiming the Republic. Then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so we ended up talking, now they're talking about, this is not the first time, as a matter of fact, if you recall, Sean, but that's been brought up before, that they wanted to make sure that anybody that went into office was significant freeholders. In other words, they owned and had clear an estate that, you know, would be, you know, I'm not sure if they're using it as a bond, or if they say down the road that they would use that as a bond so they could take it from you if you did, you know, bad things, shenanigans, what have you. But the point is that when we look at the different states, the majority of the people, or the majority of the states that have a high percentage of people that would have these high thresholds would be the Carolinas, would be Virginia, and I don't know about New York, because I know that there's not a lot of big agrarian facilities. I mean, they had agrarian, but they weren't huge plantations. They were abandoning slavery, and there was a move in the, you know, in that sector of the nation. That's where factories were coming in, and more food processing, you know, furniture, what have you, was taking a foothold, which, you know, about 100 years later was the beginning of what we call the Rust Belt. So as we look at this, I'm having a hard time understanding what the impetus of, you know, trying to create this, because ultimately, what ends up becoming the standard for anybody that's, you know, president, senator, congressman, judge, what have you?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Okay, so there is no land standard at all, right? In other words, what they created, and Madison, as much as he didn't like the illiterate, much as he didn't like the common man having a voice and what have you, he knew they had to create a system that would best serve them, not the aristocracy. And so they had to create a system that would allow them to even participate in their own government. That actually became the real shift. And we're right here still looking at August 10th. We're almost a month away from the end of the convention. And they're still thinking of this aristocracy, or this, you know, the cream of the crop would be our government. And I'm going, okay, they still haven't abandoned that. So Mr. Rutledge added to this, of South Carolina, Mr. Pinckney, now Mr. Rutledge. Let's go ahead. Let's try this. Go ahead.
Mr. Rutledge seconded the motion, observing that the committee had reported no qualifications because they could not agree on any among themselves. Being embarrassed by the danger on one side of displeasing the people by making them high, and on the other of rendering them negatory by making them low.
Okay. Mr. Ellsworth.
Mr. Ellsworth, the different circumstances of different parts of the United States and the probable difference between the present and the future circumstances of the whole render it improper to either have either uniform or fixed qualifications. Make them so high as to be useful in the southern states, and they will be inapplicable to the eastern states. Suit them to the latter, and they will serve no poor purpose in the former. In like manner, what may be accommodated to the existing state of things among us may be very inconvenient in some future state of them. He thought for these reasons that it was better to leave this matter to the legislative discretion than to attempt a provision for it in the Constitution.
And actually, they didn't leave it to their discretion either, because they didn't leave those standards open that Congress shall have the power to determine what the standards of office are. They've embossed them in these generic standards of you need to be a citizen, you need to be of a certain age and a citizen for so many years, and that was it. That was it. So when we look, and this is why when people look at the color-coded Constitution and these lines are highlighted, these qualifications are highlighted, and people go, well, how are these violations? Because the party has now created, the party system has created standards that exceed your age and your citizenship. They're now telling you that if you want to become, if you want to get into office, you need to obtain a certain amount of signatures to get your name on the ballot. In other words, they've created barriers for you to be able to get qualified to have your name on the ballot. That directly violates the Constitution for any person that is seeking to be a senator or any person seeking to be a House of Representatives or even President of the United States. As long as you meet that threshold of a natural born citizen or the amount of years as, you know, age and citizenship that is dictated in the Constitution, that is all you need to get your name on the ballot. A state that has created barriers has just abridged your right to be able to seek representation of your state legislature in the Senate, or to seek representation of the good people in the congressional district of where you live to represent them. You see my point?
Yes, I do. So why hasn't anyone challenged this?
Well, you know, it's pretty lonely being out here. Because, so one of the things I learned from John Rowland in a very few short conversations with him, I had two or three, was that, you know, when you read the Constitution, you can't read it in the mind frame of accepting the words. You have to first understand the words and then challenge the words. And what I mean by that is because that's how he created the first color-coded Constitution, is he had to challenge, is this being abided by? Is there any way, any form? Because if you go to his website, he still has the original color-coded Constitution. I took what he had and I started adopting it, and because I started challenging a lot more than what he was challenging. And I started looking and going, bottom line, this concept of creating barriers, because what they were trying to do, and this was actually being brought up, I think it was in Mr. Ellsworth, what you just read, was that it would be really basically left to the states. That this, you know, it would be improper in one state, then it would be, you know, unpolitic in another. So it would be favorable, unfavorable, unfavorable, favorable. It was just, there was no winning. And the only way to do this is really, and I think this was a part of the divine intervention. I think that any good man should be able to lead and do the right thing and actually have the courage of standing up and saying, you have no business doing this. And when we look at today's time, we have billionaires and or, you know, those type of people with that affluence either controlling or in our government controlling us. And we are actually wide open for a league of good, righteous men and women to be able to step in because the qualifications are the way they are. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. And I think I'd like you to address this as well. I mean, if you feel like it's pertinent, but like in Minnesota with Representative Ilhan Omar, she came to this country with nothing. And how did she end up getting elected?
Yeah, and so
when you've been people in states whose families have been here for generations and have a proven track record of their patriotism and service to the country, and they can't even get on the ballot.
Yes.
But this person married their brother to get citizenship for herself and her brother, or however that worked. It was nefarious. And now she's a multimillionaire, and she's all over the news and running roughshod through the Congress and just disparaging the foundations of our country. And, you know, nobody can do anything about it.
So let me look up when I'm just looking up when she immigrated. Okay. So she was a refugee coming to America in the year 2000. And so and that's when she married her brother. Coming to America, right?
No, I believe the brother marriage was for his immigration status, not hers.
Oh, okay. So anyway, she came in 2000, and so she had met the basic requirements of what the Constitution would state, but she didn't meet the basic requirements of the laws of naturalization. In other words, she had to falsely swear in her oath of a citizen to become a citizen. And if you look at everything that she has said in basically supporting Somalia over our Constitution and all these other things, because she believes that her speech, it cannot be impugned. In other words, she believes that this right of freedom of expression surpasses her responsibility, one, as a citizen, and her citizenship, as well as her legal responsibility as a public servant who is legally bound to supporting the Constitution. And she thinks that, oh, I got away with becoming a citizen, and I can get away with being as bad of a citizen and a tyrant, or I should say an enemy to the Constitution while I'm in office. That right there, folks, is a violent violation against the Constitution. And the way that the judges have reinterpreted, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, you don't look at the citizenship. Don't look at this legal responsibility of supporting the Constitution over all other things as your oath of office or as your oath of citizen. That is the law, and yet they're reinterpreting this. They're reinterpreting every facet of the law to ensure that the combatants who are here can continue to wage warfare against us. That's where we are. This is why the most maniacal institution in America today isn't the CCP. Because the CCP, if we were doing what we should be doing, they wouldn't exist. It is the court system that actually is making it possible for them to exist and operate with impunity. What she has done has been by the graces of the oracles of the bench in seeing another way to basically define what a citizen is supposed to do and what abjuring your allegiance to means, and whether you can, you know, actively be in rebellion against the Constitution while you're in office, which is a direct violation of the Constitution itself. You can't tell me Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is not a divine addition to the Constitution because it clarifies today she must be removed, and actually she should be removed from citizenship and removed from the nation, because every refugee that came here from Somalia, every refugee that came here, at least over the past several decades, I would go as back and say, leave the Vietnamese folks here, leave those people that have assimilated and actually became real participants in America. But these political, since the 1990s, these political refugees that have been brought here as combatants against the Constitution, all of them should be sent back. As a matter of fact, I mentioned this and I talked about this with Tammy, and I think you'll probably really appreciate this. That every person that has been brought here and has been given, I'll call it a yellow brick road to citizenship. In other words, they were able to bypass the citizenship process because they weren't true immigrants. Because if you come here as a invader, you are not qualified to become an immigrant. And so as we look at, you know, moving forward, then those people who have come here that have become citizens as invaders become citizens, all of them should be removed. Now, every invader, and I would not put this out of public knowledge, I'd probably want to really keep this suppressed so folks keep this quiet. What I would do is I would ship everybody out. But those few people who absolutely had done everything they could to learn the language and to prepare and legitimately follow the laws of the land of becoming a citizen and had gone through that process, I would make them the priority of allowing them to immigrate into the United States. Everybody that came here to use us and did nothing basically would never immigrate to America. The only way of becoming an American citizen is through the conversion of their state into the United States by being admitted as a state into the Union. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So, because I believe that those people who really did try, you know, by the graces of God, they were thankful and they built upon and tried to do, you know, get things right. At least they tried. I think they deserve some credit. But the people that came here because they were entitled and they were told they were entitled and acted as weapons and behaved as weapons in the United States?
Isn't it unconstitutional for the United States federal government to bring in refugees like they did from Afghanistan and Somalia and different places like that? They call them refugees?
Yeah.
What is the constitutional...
So the federal government...
For those actions, okay, wouldn't they need an amendment to change that original no importation?
No. So what happened is the federal government signed an unconstitutional treaty adjoining to the UN and basically subjugating us to international law. And then as we were members of the UN, there was another treaty. There were several treaties that we signed into, all of them unconstitutional because we should never been the president and the federal government has no authority to adjoin the United States to a foreign entity, period. That's not within their enumerated powers. In other words, if they don't have the power to do it, they have no ability to create the treaty. This, if you read Petition 2, we go through this whole point of treaties. They can only make a treaty under those things that we've enumerated or empowered them to do. So they created a treaty that was illegitimate. And then down the road, the UN in the 1950s or 60s, created a new treaty that would have nations of the world that could do this, you know, those who had the money and the ability to become humanitarian states would sign a treaty to become a humanitarian state and allow refugees to come into the United States or come into their nation by, you know, basically dislocating or displacing them permanently into your nation. The real guys or the real idea was to temporarily bring them into the let's things stabilize so you can send them back. But that's not how it went, and that's not how it played. So when we look in Vietnam, or after Vietnam, in the late 70s and early 80s, they were brought in. And when we look at with Russia, after Russia fell, some of them were brought in. But that really became far more political. And even though we've got a lot of really good Russians here, what ended up happening was they started making sure that the Russian mob was coming in and being able to operate using, you know, human trafficking and all the crap that they've been getting away with. when we look beyond the 1990s, because that's when all of a sudden the Islamic states started coming into America. I think you'll find that when, look it up, when were the refugees brought into Dearborn, Michigan? Because that'll give you a good timeline of how long it took for them to amass a level of control in Dearborn to where now they basically rule them. Unconstitutionally, illegally, this is all being done. The federal government has no authority to manage immigration of persons or importation of persons. That was only given to the states. Their only constitutional responsibility is to regulate the state's importation of people. They have no authority to say, we're going to import our own people. Because bottom line, every person that is being brought into the United States does not go to D.C. They're not citizens and inhabitants of the District of Columbia when the federal government brings them in. They're going straight into the states, which is why the states were to have the cognitive authority over it. The states were supposed to be able to say, no, 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 we don't want those kind of people here. They're not going to assimilate. They're not going to do well here. Hopefully that makes
it's
sense.
Crazy when you look at it. And it's the information I have shows the first, they came in multiple ways. 67 from Palestine, displaced by Arab-Israeli war. 75, Lebanese civil war. Uh-huh. 91, Iraq Shia refugees. Another wave of Iraq and Syrians.
Yep. Right.
Afghan, Somali, Yemen.
Yeah, so when did the call to prayer get institutionalized in Dearborn?
I know that in North Carolina, the governor just signed a proclamation declaring that North Carolina officially celebrates Ramadan now.
Yeah, and you know what? All of these placaters, you know, we've got to help either cure them, or we're going to have to start taking and revoking citizenship of them, because their job is not to support, you know, other states and nations over our Constitution, period. Their job under oath is to fully support the Constitution and the rule of law. And by allowing a theocracy to get a foothold, and allowing a theocracy to start invoking their own unconstitutional law, their own unconstitutional government, and on and on and on, just speaks volumes. These people obviously do not know what they're doing, and they need to be relieved. And if they pursue, then I think they need to be deported, along with these people that shouldn't be here in the first place. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that that happened probably in the 60s because of the Israeli war, the Seven-Day War, and so forth. So, but those were probably small numbers. But still, you know, it wasn't the big numbers that we started seeing in the 90s. And that's when they really started bringing large quantities. If you really look, Vietnam was the large quantity of people being brought into America during the 60s and 70s, Vietnam, and other refugees in that area.
But that's a whole different scenario, I believe. When you look at it ideologically and the way things actually transpired, those people were being overtaken by communist forces. And the culture in that area is a whole lot different than the ones that we're discussing now.
Yeah, but it goes back to their
assimilation.
Yeah, it goes back to really does the scenario doesn't matter. Just like conservative, progressive,
right,
it doesn't matter. If the power is not there, they can't do it. And so what should have happened is the states who have the ability would then be able to say, we want to be recipients and we will import these people. But they wouldn't be able to necessarily just import these people. This is where, again, when we talk about foreign trade and so forth, this is where if the states were cooperating with each other and they all basically said, Islam is considered, you know, they're at war with us. These are combatants coming here. They shouldn't be here. Get them out of here and no more. We're banning them. We're shutting down their mosques. And, you know, we're not even going to send them their mosques and their stuff. We'll just repurpose it for better purposes for, you know, America and liberty. because they're not entitled to the property they've obtained here, because everything that they've obtained has all been under the auspices of fraud. No true authority. It's the same thing with the Tories. The Tories lost everything because they chose to be British loyalists. There you go. Yeah.
And one thing that I always come back to when I see all these people talking about, oh, well, Americans are just being xenophobic or bigots or whatever. How many countries in the world allow you to go there without notice or documentation or anything and just show up and say, I want to live here. Now give me stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. It's just like elections. It's the same thing. Every other place that has any kind of civilized society, you have to show an identification to vote. But here in the land of liberty, no.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's expected from us, but nobody else. Nobody gets shamed. Right. Nobody gets called out. I mean, because we've been indoctrinated to, you know, to bear this burden, you know, to a level of guilt that is just unreasonable, and it is just it's emotional. It makes no sense. There's nothing logical about it. There's no nation in the world that is held to these same standards that they're asking us to be held to. No nation.
It's a symptom of our standard of living. People are so comfortable and everything is so convenient and their lives are so, they're so, they so well off in comparison to the rest of the world that they have nothing else to worry about. So they feel like they have to do something for their virtue and their empathy.
There you go. Okay. So hopefully this helps. Let's get back to a little bit more, because we've got about 1 minute left, and I think Dr. Franklin is the next one up, so let's read his.
Dr. Franklin expressed his dislike of everything that tended to debase the spirit of the common people. If honesty was often the companion of wealth, and if poverty was exposed to peculiar temptation, it was not less true that the possession of property increased the desire of more property. Some of the greatest rogues he was ever acquainted with were the richest rogues. We should remember the character with which the scripture requires in rulers, that they should be men hating covetousness. This constitution will be much read and attended to in Europe, and if it should betray a great partiality to the rich, will not only hurt us in the esteem of the most liberal and enlightened men there, but discourage the common people from moving into this country.
There you go. Okay, so we'll stop there, because Madison then comes up, because they didn't move forward on the motion. But as we look at this progressing, again, this is really the talk about property and the federal government kind of being the umpires of, you know, these controversies between states and so forth, that how did they become the dictators? How did these umpires elevate themselves to become the oligarchy of gods and the oligarchy of all things, the grand poobah of our government, and literally transform our Republican form of government into a judiciary form of government? Think about that, folks. We'll be back. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description version of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.